Why do we do the things that we do? Robert Zwolski, a celebrated Stanford primatologist and neurobiologist, tackles this age-old question in his investigation into the science of human behavior in his book, Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst. From violence and aggression to cooperation and empathy, Zwolski explores what we can do better to better understand our relationship to one another. He argues that we should not distinguish between aspects of a behavior that are biological and those that are cultural because they are utterly intertwined. Human social behavior is shaped by many factors, including brain chemistry, hormones, early experience, biological and cultural evolutions, and ecological pressures. Robert Zwolski is a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University and a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Again, the name of the new book is Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Very nice to have you on the show. The book is now out in paperback. What has it been like talking about this book for a year and the way it's been received and our understanding of how we do indeed behave?
Well, one of the things that comes through in talking with people lots about this, the biology of what makes us who we are, is you spend a lot of time thinking about neurons and hormones and genes and early experience and culture and evolution, all of that. And out the other end of it comes the recognition that really like hits a lot of people like a shock, which is that there's a lot less free will than people are normally comfortable thinking about. And we are subject to biology in a lot more circumstances than occurs to most people. And that's a very unsettling realization I've been seeing.
When you started this investigation and working on this book, how much of it was new in the sense of something that you wanted to explore specifically, and how much of it was really a culmination of the work that you've been doing for so long?
In some ways, more the latter. I've spent decades being a neuroscientist in the lab and splitting my time between that and studying wild primates out in the field in East Africa. I've been doing back and forth for more than 30 years and teaching this stuff. And what you begin to see after a while is like our behavior really cannot be seen outside the context of the biology going on in us. Most of the time, it's biology we haven't a clue about. It's all these subterranean biological influences sort of rumbling along beneath the surface. But we are no more or less biological organisms than any other species out there. And, you know, more complexly so in our case, but nothing we do is outside the context of biology.
So you argue that we should not distinguish between aspects of a behavior that are biological and those that are cultural because they are utterly intertwined. Talk about
absolutely.
Yeah, so talk about that intertwining and what that means.
Well, I mean, sort of as a first step, okay, so let's bring culture into it. First off, culture, whatever our ancestors invented centuries ago, where do different cultures come from? They come from different ecosystems. Desert dwellers invent different sorts of religions than rainforest dwellers. People who plant crops that require big collective efforts, like rice farmers, produce completely different attitudes about, you know, social norms and norm violation than people who grow crops that are much more individualistic in the sort of work they involve. And so we've got sort of ecological roots in inventing culture. And then it turns out, like, what your ancestors were up to culturally is going to influence the way you were raised within minutes of birth. You know, just as one example, one of the big contrasts that people look at is the difference between what are called collectivist cultures, and those are like most frequently studied rice-growing regions of Southeast Asia, or individualist cultures. Americans are like the poster children of individualism in that regard. And you see within minutes of birth differences on the average in how long infants are held by their mothers, depending on which culture that's in, at what age you were weaned, how long you let a baby cry before you pick that child up, what volume on the average mothers sing their lullabies at. In other words, within minutes of birth, you were being shaped by the cultures your ancestors invented centuries ago. And so in that regard, it's impossible to separate the two. There's genetic differences that reflect longstanding cultural and ecological differences, you know, even in the realm of, like, culture, which is supposedly the most definedly social, parentheses, non-biological thing that we do. It's an utterly biological process.
This idea, and you write about this, of the necessity to understand the neurobiology of our emotions in order to understand the roots, the real reasons for good and evil of what exists there. Why is that neurobiology so important?
Well, the neurobiology is sort of the final output of all those endocrine and genetic and early experience and cultural and evolutionary pressures coming before that. But why is it important? Because everybody is already a behavioral biologist. Everybody is already making assessments about behavior based on how much free will they think there is, how much volition. Every time you serve on a jury, you are making decisions about what you think biology has to do with behavior. Every time you're assessing a kid who isn't doing as well at school as you might want them to, every time you're dealing with a family member who you have to decide, are they just sort of in a self-indulgent funk or are they suffering from clinical depression? In all those cases, you are making assessments implicitly about what biology has to do with our behavior. So it's a really good thing if we're actually informed about it in the process.
In looking at that understanding that to be informed of the process, so how do we become better informed? How do we understand what that is and what's happening, not only for us, but for others?
Well, I think the key thing, first off, is probably the most key thing for most people is to overcome like a critical fact they learned somewhere around ninth grade, which is like biology is boring and mostly irrelevant and like keep it as far away from me as possible. Once that one is overcome, probably the most important thing is to just sort of think of us as, you know, humans are animals. We're a primate, we're an ape, we're a mammal. In most ways, our basic like building blocks of our brains and our hormones are virtually identical to every other species out there. There's some pretty exciting, dramatic differences. A chimp will kill another chimp over a territorial dispute. A human will kill another human over symbols, over ideology, over theology, over differences in like economic outlooks to things, all sorts of stuff that would make no sense to a chimp at all. But nonetheless, it's the same underlying biological circuitry. And that's sort of a first step in sort of putting us in the right place in nature. We're a very fancy, very unique, very distinctive animal, but at the end of the day, we're built on the same stuff as every other animal out there.
And that idea, I mean, even that idea is foreign to people, right? That we're the same as the other animals. To think of us even in that realm.
Well, it's, you know, people are very taken with exceptionalism, the ways in which we are quite unique, but, take a brain cell from us and take a brain cell from a frog or a fruit fly and stick it under a microscope, and you can't tell which one is which. And it's the same. We did not become human because we invented a completely new type of way of our brain cells talking to each other or inventing completely novel neurochemicals or whatever. The thing that makes us us is just an extension of the same building blocks in lots of ways. I mean, the thing that's most unique about us in terms of our behavior is just the sheer number of neurons that are going at it amid us having the same basic type of brain cells as a fruit fly. For every one that a fruit fly has, we have 100 million. And you throw enough of them together, you get enough quantity, and you start inventing all sorts of qualities that, like, leave fruit flies or leave chimps far behind in our wake, but nonetheless the same basic construction.
That construction, and as you point out in the book, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Our Worst, even through understanding this, is there a way of avoiding the worst, or is that always, I mean, that's just going to happen because that's life?
Well, one of the useful things for my sitting in my living room for 4 years writing this, like, ridiculously long book is that I am by nature a pessimist. And when you read enough about the subject, you're kind of forced to admit that there's, like, some room for optimism. This is a much kinder, more empathic world than it was 200-300 years ago, even though, like, the daily news each night makes it hard for us to recognize that. We're extending empathy in all sorts of directions that would have been unimaginable back when. We're learning that brains can change to a far greater extent than anybody used to appreciate. We're even learning what circumstances make it easier for that to happen and for the changes to go in a good direction rather than a bad one. We're learning a lot about how stuff about human behavior works, and out of that comes a lot of tools for how to nudge things in a slightly more optimistic direction. So, assuming we don't do ourselves in as a species, where I think there's lots of reasons to feel some optimism, a science of what makes us behave the way we do offers a lot of, optimistic lessons.
I'll take optimism where I can get it. The name of the book is Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst. It is published by Penguin Press, out in paperback. Robert Sapolsky, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.